Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, of course, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Joseph Smith, who's written a book titled Under God, and it's the story of George Washington and his views about this wall of separation between church and state. Now, Mr. Smith graduated from Yale University, took his law degree, serves as an assistant attorney general in the state of Denver, and presently practices law in Denver, Colorado. In addition to that, of course, he had a co-author, who I really don't know too much about, but the apparently very nice woman, who is very concerned about this same subject. And they collaborated on this fascinating book based upon the writings of George Washington. What did George Washington really believe? Of course, George Washington is a pivotal figure in America. For indeed, he was first in war and first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. He was universally respected in many respects. He was a very humble man. He really believed in America. He did not want to necessarily be the president of the United States. He wanted to live his life after the Revolutionary War, but when his country called him to service, he came. But of course, the question is, was he a deist? Did he believe in God? How would he feel about the wall of separation that has been created in the United States, which is aimed at destroying the Christian foundations of this once great Christian republic? So with that as a background, Mr. Smith, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't you tell us what motivated you to write the book?
It was really, perhaps by good fortune, reading George Washington's major speeches, which unfortunately too many people, even students, don't do these days, but being a guy who likes sticking his nose into a book from time to time, I was reading Washington, and for those listeners who have read, and perhaps you've read, his first inaugural address or his second inaugural address, his farewell address, just the most famous of his speeches, they're all strikingly religious, and especially to the modern ear, when we have this familiar concept that we've been told over and over again that there's a separation between church and state. The words jump off the page, and you think this guy Washington was out there. He was so religious in his public speeches. So it became a fascinating topic for me. I tried to find a book about it, and I found that no one had written a book about it. So I thought, somebody's got to write this book, and I recruited my co-author, Tara Ross, who's also an attorney, and previously had written another book about the American founding, and we together dug into it, and we reviewed all of Washington's writings, not just the most famous ones, all of his speeches, all of his letters that have survived, all of his papers that have survived, and took the broadest survey possible of everything George Washington ever said or wrote that's known to history about the interaction between government and religion. And we produced this book, which is a combination of our telling of that story, but also the second half, roughly, of the book is actually a compilation of Washington's own speeches and letters and papers on the issue. We really encourage readers to see for yourself. Don't take our word for it.
And I think, of course, it's so interesting. You start with the story of the French-Indian War, where, Washington was a colonel then with the British Army, and of course they were ambushed by the Indians, and he actually had four bullets in his coat. Two horses were shot out from under him, and he survived unscathed. And at that point, he began to realize that Providence was, or of course this would be another word for God, was really protecting him. Do you want to tell that story? Because I think it's so important. It is pivotal to George Washington's whole outlook upon life, about why he was in the military. And it seemed that he was not to be killed in battle, because God was going to preserve him. We'll be back in just a moment with Joseph Smith. Joseph, you pick up the story there.
Okay, you've done a great job telling it, but I will do a little retelling.
You go right ahead, because it's such an important story. It's a story that needs to be told over and over again. Go right ahead.
Well, I was saying, you told it very well. The French and Indian War was a war in which Washington was fighting, of course, as part of the British military. He was serving as a relatively junior officer at that time, his youngest, you know, the youngest he was in any position of public responsibility. And the troops encountered the enemy in a terrible situation, or certainly a situation that became terrible. The British troops were decimated, and Washington was among the few survivors and really had no business surviving. As you mentioned, horses being shot out from under him, bullets through his coat, and he wrote to his brother saying he had no doubt whatsoever that God had saved him and had actively intervened. And that really became a theme for Washington as far as his personal faith went, that God was playing an active role in the founding of what became the United States, and in the protection of George Washington in particular, you know, in a personal way. And Washington, as you mentioned in the introduction, is really a very modest and humble and private man. And there's been a big debate coming forward in history about exactly what his personal religious views were, and there's room to debate it, but there's not room to debate whether or not he believed in God. He clearly believed in God, and he not only believed that God existed, but he believed that God was actively involved in his life and in the founding of America, the French and Indian War being one of the earliest episodes where his belief in that becomes very apparent.
And of course, and this really guided everything that happened after that, and this idea that really America was really chosen by God. This was to be a unique and marvelous country. And in our military, why, of course, the soldiers were not to swear. They were to be moral people. They were to be Christian soldiers. And of course, you point out and stress how George Washington insisted on having chaplains with every unit. Because
he did indeed. And he, in fact, again, still back in the days when he was serving in the British military, he was fighting as a commander in the military with the colonial governor, that is the British governor of Virginia, to get public funds to pay those chaplains.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joseph Smith. The book is Under God. It's a story of George Washington. What's the rest of the subtitle of the book?
The subtitle is George Washington and the Question of Church and State.
Right, and of course, if you read the book, you'll realize, of course, there's no question of a wall of separation between church and state, because George Washington, time and time and time again, called upon God publicly, through his military action, through his political action as a politician, realizing, of course, it was only divine providence that had rescued him during the ambush there, during the French and Indian War. And, of course, time and time again, he insisted that they have, with his military units, they have chaplains. He didn't want his soldiers swearing. He didn't want his soldiers drinking or gambling. He wanted them to be Christian soldiers, and he said as much. So pick the story up from there.
Well, what you've described, in essence, became Washington's view of the Republic in general, and it was a view rooted in his military experience. And that was, as the Republic came into being, Washington had formed a very strong view that in order for a people, free people, to govern themselves, they needed to be a moral people and a virtuous people. And he believed in order for any people to be moral and virtuous, they had to have religion. That belief about the general political structure of the United States went straight back to his time serving in the military and commanding other soldiers, where he strongly believed that the soldiers needed to go and ordered them, in fact, to go to religious services, have days of prayer, and he wanted to have publicly funded military chaplains. And that's a great example where we get specifically into the issue of church and state, as opposed to merely Washington's personal religious views. Washington strongly believed that the government should pay for those military chaplains. And back in the day, when he was serving in the British military, trying to get those chaplains from the colonial governor, and like any military leader, he had trouble getting money for a variety of things, but that was one of them. Some of his officers, some of Washington's officers, came forward and said, "We agree with you. There should be chaplains in the military. We know you're having trouble getting money from the colonial government. We offer to take money out of our own pockets and pay the chaplains." And Washington specifically said, "No, we're not going to pay them privately. This is part of government's job, to have chaplains ministering to the troops. So again, they can be virtuous and moral people," and part of what he viewed eventually in the grand sense of the Republic, be a self-governing people.
How different that is today, where, of course, there's various groups, the American Civil Liberties Union and the Committee on the Separation of Church and State are doing everything they can, of course, to prevent the chaplains of the military from praying in the name of God. I'm sure they'd like to get them out of there altogether. They would like us to be a totally secular, godless society. But, of course, as George Washington said in his farewell address, and do you have that handy? His farewell address really is one of the most profound statements of the relationship between freedom and belief in God.
I do have it handy, and I would even take a moment, if it's all right with you, to introduce it by reminding people, since we don't study Washington anymore as much as we really should, that George Washington in his day was, even while alive, before he had passed on and was considered kind of a hero of the past, while he was alive, he was considered the first man of his generation, the first among equals, the greatest American, and certainly one of the greatest living people on earth. So he knew when he was president and when he was leaving the presidency, he knew he was setting an example, and he knew that his words were taken as being very authoritative as to what the United States was all about, why there had been a revolution, what the future of mankind looked like with this new republic on the face of the earth. So he was not one who put his name to things or let himself speak words without giving very careful consideration to them. And you asked about his farewell address in particular, what was going to be his last major address as President of the United States, a very important speech. And he said in it, and now I'm quoting from George Washington, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and cherish them. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity." That's the key passage on our topic, the relationship between church and state, where Washington, laid down his views in his farewell address and wanted there to be no question about what he thought.
Well, without religion and morality, there could never be, of course, a stable society. And how different that is today when, of course, our Supreme Court has taken God and the Ten Commandments out of our schools, even though, of course, they still open their sessions with a statement that the crier comes in and says, "God bless the United States and this honorable court." I would think every one of those Supreme Justices would choke on those words.
Well, not only that,
the Supreme Court is done.
The tablets of the Ten Commandments are on the wall of the U.S. Supreme Court. They haven't been removed there.
No, they haven't. Of course, you'll find them in the door. You'll find them, in the brief outside at the very, very top of the building as you approach the building, a replica of the Ten Commandments. They know, of course, that Christianity was the foundation of this country. And yet, of course, the people in the Supreme Court had a different agenda. But let's not argue their point of view. Your book wants to make the point that George Washington believed that God and religion and morality were inseparable if we were going to have an organized society. And time again he wrote about this, didn't he, in the numerous letters that you quote in your book.
He did. We've collected and presented many. There are literally too many relevant letters and speeches to put into one book. It would be enormous. That's how frequently Washington wrote or spoke on the issue, which a lot of people simply don't realize. But we have collected for the reader the vast majority of those that speak most clearly to the issue, so that people can read Washington's own words. But again, you know, I always feel like I need to remind listeners who think they're familiar with Washington, or certainly everyone knows Washington was the first president, but many people don't know, or schools no longer really teach, that Washington had four decades of public service, which culminated in his service as president, but started out when he was in the colonial military. Then he served as a legislator in Virginia. Then he was commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, that is, the American army that fought against the British. Then he served as president of the Constitutional Convention, when, of course, the Constitution was drafted. Then he became the first president of the United States, and then he was reelected to be president of the United States. And that period, his second term as president of the United States, is especially important for the issue of church and state, because that's when the First Amendment to the Constitution was passed. And some of your listeners surely know, but others may not, that it's the First Amendment to the Constitution that really addresses the relationship between government and religion. And it's the First Amendment of the Constitution that says government shall, in essence, Congress shall make no law that establishes religion or that prohibits the free exercise of religion. So Washington was president both before and after passage of that amendment, which makes his interpretation of it absolutely key, and we see in his approach really no change between before and after. He didn't see the First Amendment as changing any of his views as to how government and religion should interact.
And I think you make the point, of course, there were many, many religions, Christian religions here. There were the Quakers. There were the Christian Catholics. There certainly were the Presbyterians and the Baptists. And there were a number of religious sects. The Congregationalists were very strong. Washington himself was an Anglican. And nobody wanted any other person's branch of Christianity, sect of Christianity, become the official religion of the state. And that's really was the basis of the First Amendment, wasn't it? So that we would never have a state religion, and yet it was never to separate Christianity from government.
Well, that's true so far as it goes. It's also important to remember that even 200 years ago, 200 and what is it, 30-ish years ago, there were already Jews in America. There were already Muslims in America, believe it or not. Now, there were both the Jews and the Muslims were here in very small numbers. There were atheists in America as well, also in relatively small numbers. It was overwhelmingly a nation populated by various Christian sects, all those you list, of course, and including the Roman Catholics. So Washington was dealing, especially in the military, with a religiously diverse population, although very much a majority Christian population. But he, you know, by way of example, it was Washington who personally put an end to what was called Pope's Day back in the time when the military, the Protestant military, members of the military would burn once a year. There was a day where they would burn the Pope in effigy. And Washington said, cut it out. It's childish. And we need the Canadians, who are Roman Catholics, as our allies, the French, who are Roman Catholics. You know, we don't want to be offending people left and right. So Washington was taking great care back in a day when, you know, many people assume people were all kind of in rough agreement on religion. There was already religious strife in that day, and Washington was taking great care to be fair to everyone, and to guarantee everyone's religious liberty, not just that of a particular sect. And certainly, as you say, he agreed with all the American founders that there should be no national church of the United States in the way that there had been a national church of England, where the monarch, King George III at the time, was not only the head of state, but was also the head of the church.
And I think it's really so important that people understand that this was predominantly a Protestant nation, rather than the Catholics, of course, came in great droves with the Irish, and certainly there were Catholics predominantly up in Canada, and there were some Catholics here, but it was predominantly a Protestant nation, and there was sort of this fear that the Catholics got into positions of power, and then, of course, America would be ruled by the Pope, and so it was really for the fear, perhaps prejudicial fear, but certainly they did not want to have any one religion. controlling their society because they wanted to be free.
That's true. I think you're absolutely right about that.
Go right ahead.
Well, I think you sum it up well about what was going on with the religious dynamics of the day. I don't know if there's much more to be said.
All right, fine. Well, we don't have to beat a dead horse. Have you seen the motion picture that's being shown on television, John Adams?
I've got to see it because you're not the first person to ask me this, but no, I haven't, and I keep hearing from people that it's worth watching. And I intend to see it, but I have to tell you, I have not watched it yet.
Well, they had four parts of it so far, and there'll be, of course, the next ones this coming weekend. But they depict George Washington, especially his inauguration, and of course, there's thousands of people there to see it. And of course, Washington, just by his stature, he's a huge man compared with John Adams, who's just a little tiny guy standing next to him. And of course, John Adams is the vice president. Washington is the president. But the swearing in was really so beautifully depicted because you could barely hear what Washington was saying. You know, the fellow was administering the oath, was shouting out the words, and Washington was almost whispering them, and everybody in the audience is trying to hear. And you just saw the humility of this man. He's inaugurated the first president of the United States, but he's not there to aggrandize himself. I think that they've done a wonderful job, at least what I've seen so far, of depicting the various characters who were instrumental in creating our country, whether it be Adams, Jefferson, Washington, Franklin. They're all beautifully portrayed, I think, very much, very true to life.
That's great to hear, and that's consistent with what I've heard, and, you know, any portrayal of Washington that's going to be accurate needs to capture that, because if you get to know Washington by reading, you know, history, reading what Washington wrote, you know, I don't think there's a historian who disagrees that Washington was by nature kind of a commanding figure, as you say, but really modest and was, you know, frequently drawn out of private life with some reluctance to serve as a great leader because people so respected him, and he did not go about campaigning for positions of leadership, but rather was really drafted into them. And he, you know, again, I mentioned earlier, he was the president of the Constitutional Convention. People often don't think of Washington as a constitutional, you know, interpreter, but he was the president of that convention. He didn't speak often in the debates because everyone, including Washington, knew that if this Constitution got ratified and there was a chief executive of the new American nation, it was going to be George Washington. So he did not want to be stepping forward and getting into the debates about what powers the president should or shouldn't have, what powers Congress should or shouldn't have vis-a-vis the president, because people knew he was in essence talking about himself. And so he refrained from speaking most often, not all the time, but usually refrained from speaking, but still he was, you know, he was there every day, and he was the commanding figure of his age and of that convention.
And, of course, I think there were many, many people who really wanted to have a more centralized government, almost like a monarchy here. And George Washington, though, would have nothing of that. He did not want to be a king. He did not want to be a ruler. He believed, of course, in this idea of a Christian republic. And that's exactly what we were given. Thanks to that Constitutional Convention, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course the story our guest today is Joseph Smith. His book is Under God. It's the story of George Washington, and of course the first part of the book, of course, chronicles George Washington's life, and of course time and time again, when it appeared that the American army was going to be defeated, why God would intervene, rather with rain or with storms or whatever it would be, with fog, so that the Americans, of course, could retreat and not be destroyed. And time and again, the British were ready to destroy the American army, and Providence, or God, or call it what you will, intervene. Did you have that feeling as you read his papers?
Yes, it's unavoidable. Even if you happen to be a reader who would disagree with Washington. If you are, at least, let's say, an honest atheist reading George Washington's works, you cannot come away from them with any ambiguity about the fact that Washington saw God's intervention in human events as part of what, of how history was unfolding during his lifetime. And you mentioned, you know, storm sweeping in to save the American army, basically by obscuring them, you know, during a battle or something like events like that. Washington absolutely believed that was God intervening, and didn't simply wait for events like that to happen, but was among those, and certainly not alone in this belief, but among those who actively prayed, you know, for God's continuing watch over the nation or the cause. You know, shortly after the Boston Tea Party, and the colonists were obviously making known their opinions of the of British rule, and things were getting quite tense, the Virginia legislature voted, and Washington was then a Virginia legislator, for a day of public fasting and prayer, and that was something that Washington voted for, voting for, you know, a day where government was urging the public to pray for God's intervention to help the Americans against the British. And he not only voted for it in some kind of formulaic way, he voted for it, and then on the day, his diary says, went to church. So he participated in it.
And, of course, this was very, very common in those days to have a day of fasting and prayer, because, of course, we were predominantly a godly nation in those days. How different we are today, as these ideas and our heroes of the past have been pretty well forgotten, as we've done away, of course, with George Washington's birthday, which used to be a major holiday. Now we have President's Day. How different America is than we were perhaps 100 years ago, when George Washington was really looked to still then as first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Well, did you come away after reading this and recording this, certainly George Washington's writings, with a respect for this man?
Again, it's unavoidable. Yes, is the short answer to that question. You read what George Washington went through, especially the formative years as a younger man in the military, as a relatively self-educated man, you know, not someone who fancied himself a theoretician in the way Thomas Jefferson did, not someone who, you know, wanted to be a public spectacle, but someone who really kind of had his eye on the horizon, had very, you know, long-term interests of his countrymen at the front of his mind at all times, and repeatedly, you know, devoted himself, despite being a man of great talents, and eventually a man of substantial wealth, too, who for either of those reasons, or both, could have declined public service. He didn't need to be the Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army. He didn't need to serve as President of the Constitutional Convention. He didn't need to serve as President of the United States. Remember, and that's back at a time when it was entirely unclear that the American experiment would succeed. I mean, now, of course, you say who would pass up, if it were handed to you, the opportunity to be president. But he was going to be the first president, and he might have been a spectacular failure. So he didn't need to do any of these things where he literally was putting, certainly in the military, his life on the line, but then later, as in political office, putting his fortune, his reputation, his personal you know, circumstances, his simple ability to be with his wife and family, putting all of that on the line. He didn't need to do any of that, especially as he became a man of increased stature over time. He could have easily said, my public service has been done, and it's been very successful, and now it's time for others to step forward. But he was repeatedly drafted into the public service, and he repeatedly and selflessly said yes.
Well, Chris, one of the questions is, do you think he was a Christian, as we would assume a Christian today, who believed in the divinity of Jesus Christ? Certainly, he believed in God, he believed in providence, he believed in this hand of, the spiritual hand that was guiding him. But, you know, Chris, do we know whether or not, of course, he would be considered, by modern standards, an evangelical Christian or a born-again Christian? Well, anyway, we'll be back in just a moment with our guest, Joseph Smith. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and it's a question as I read the book through, and certainly I think that George Washington is an ideal figure, certainly a man of God, but do you think he would agree with modern-day Christianity and its thoughts?
You know, Washington's personal beliefs, personal religious beliefs, as opposed to the way he thought government should interact with religion, his personal religious beliefs have been, for years and years, since shortly after he died, the subject of controversy and debate. And there are still, I think just last year it was, a book came out by Robert Novak and his daughter, and I forget the title, unfortunately, but it is an article, I mean, or rather a book, about Washington's personal religious beliefs. They argue that the evidence shows that he was a Christian. Others have argued that he was a deist, meaning he believed in some sort of supreme being, but much more remotely, more akin to an agnostic or something like that. And I have to be frank with you that the purpose of the book that I've co-written with Tara Ross about Washington's approach to church and state, we don't attempt to resolve that debate. In fact, we come to a point in the book where we say Washington's belief, demonstrated belief, in government support for religion and government's accommodation of religion is all the more powerful if you, for whatever reason, want to believe Washington was a less religious man. You know, he was a deist of some sort. And interestingly, what we observed in looking through all of his writings was that he was more religious in his public statements, in his public speeches, than he was in his private correspondence. So he seemed, for whatever reason, to strongly believe that his public role, whether it was as a general or as a political figure, as president, that his public role, public office, called on him to be a very demonstrably religious or have a demonstrably religious approach, even more than his private correspondence.
And yet, of course, you show some private correspondence when he does repeatedly talk about God or
providence. Oh, sure. And you kind of want to go into this by emphasizing what we've really written about. Now, all that said, I'm happy to, since I've read through everything Washington has ever said about religion, I'm happy to comment on your question and just first to review some of the facts. What is known to everyone, regardless of where you come down on...
Now, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought because sure. We're going to bring some of our stations back on board, and I want our listeners to hear what you have to say about whether Washington would be considered a traditional Christian today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joseph Smith. We're talking about his book, Under God, and it really it deals with George Washington and his relationship to God, and how certainly a society really was dependent upon having a God. You could not have an active society, either a military or a society, unless you had this belief in religion and morality were the very foundation of society. And then, of course, I ask the question, well, was certainly George Washington, by common standards of today, would he have been considered a Christian? Would he have been considered a deist? Would he have been considered a deeply religious man who believed in Jesus Christ and his teachings, but did not necessarily believe that he was God? And so certainly Joseph was just going to tell us what he believes after having read it. Now, that is not the function of the book. The function of the book is really very, very straightforward. Is to point out that George Washington would never have thought there was a wall of separation between church and state because he believed society could not exist unless the people had religious beliefs and moral beliefs, and I believe that's true today. I believe that people who are trying to destroy the religious foundation of this America really want to destroy America. But let's get back to the subject at hand. What do you think about George Washington's belief about Christianity? We know he was an Anglican, he attended church regularly, but you pick up the story there.
I was going to start with kind of the facts that we know, regardless of what opinion you draw from them. We know that he was a lifelong member of the Anglican Church. He was baptized in the Anglican Church. He was married in the Anglican Church. He served as a vestryman in two different parishes within the Anglican Church, and he was also the godfather to children within the Anglican Church. So there seems to be little question that he had, at some level, you know, a broad acceptance of that church's tenets. There's been a suggestion, and I find it interesting, is about all I can say, because I just haven't gotten into the business of really trying to read George Washington's mind when I don't have evidence, and I don't think there's anything in writing about this. But there's been a suggestion that when the war broke out, the revolution broke out, because King George was the head of not only Great Britain, but the head of the Anglican Church, that Washington felt uncomfortable continuing to go to Anglican services because it was somehow an acknowledgement of the authority of King George. And as I said, all I can really say about that is I think it's interesting. I think it's plausible. I don't know of anything in writing that proves that one way or not, you know, proves or disproves that that was a concern of Washington's. But it does sound plausible to me. He was very concerned about public impressions that he left. And I think it would be a matter of concern for the sworn enemy of the revolutionaries to be the head of the church that you attend and, in essence, swear allegiance to. So that's a striking fact that at the time would have been apparent to everyone, and we don't think so much about today because we don't actively think of the monarch of Great Britain being the head of the Anglican Church. We also know that Washington was a Freemason, as were many men of his age. That required that he state, you know, affirm a belief in a divine entity. That much is known, although the Freemasons had a religious diversity within their membership, so it doesn't tell you everything there is to know about his beliefs. It also required that he believe in an afterlife, so we know that to be among his beliefs. What is very clear, going back to some of our earlier discussion, is that he did believe that God actively intervened in his own life and in human events.
And because that is in contrast to the deist who, you know, thinks that that God created the world and then and let it run on its own.
Right, and that's my general impression coming away from it. Again, my own expertise not being so much Washington's personal religious beliefs, but being more acquainted than most with the topic, I come away with the impression that he was a pretty conventional Protestant, basically Anglican, you know, Christian, with perhaps some issues about the Anglican Church once Great Britain became the sworn enemy of the United States. And I find nothing in the historical record that I've seen, at least, to contradict that. And as you say, it's his basic approach to, or should I say, the evidence showing his belief in God's intervention in human affairs seems to run against the suggestion that he was a deist, although there have been those who have taken up the cause of trying to prove he's a deist, and I can't say I've read every book about that and can give you point by point why they're wrong, but I don't come away with that impression.
Well, I think there's some people who want to destroy any suggestion that America was a Christian country, that God played an important part in forming this country. I believe that there's an organized, orchestrated effort to undermine our faith in Christianity by undermining our faith in the men who created our country, and certainly. But I think that Washington, you know, at least I have read some of the things that he wrote as a young man about Christianity, and it would appear to me that he really was a Christian, certainly in many of the modern ways, although we don't see him talking about that so much as he, you know, in his correspondence he talks about God but not about Christ, and yet a lot of people don't necessarily talk about Christ, and yet they are Christians.
It is interesting, you know. He does, and anyone who reads our book or looks at the original materials would quickly realize that he seems to have a preference for phrases like the divine ruler or the providence or, you know, the hand that rules the world, these kind of more poetic ways of referring to God. And it's clear enough that he's referring to God. And it's also clear, for that matter, that he's referring to, you know, a monotheistic kind of belief. He doesn't refer in the plural to gods in some sort of, you know, Greek or Roman sense. He does, though, emphasize this kind of non-denominational, or tends toward this non-denominational language, yet, at the same time, he did support a proposal to use public funds to provide a Bible, you know, a Christian Bible, to every soldier in the military. Now, that actually ended up not happening because the war ended before it could really come about. But that's an interesting, you know, specific fact that most people are not aware of. He also supported proposals and measures to fund Christian missionaries to the Indians.
Well, and certainly that would suggest, you know, very strongly that he was a Christian, because he wasn't pushing another religion. He was actually encouraging Christianity to be taught to the Indians, and of course, believing that would, of course, allow them to, to adopt our ways, because, of course, our freedoms were based upon Christianity. The whole idea that it was God that gave us our freedom, and, of course, at that time was looked upon as Jesus Christ, and there was no separation between certainly a belief in Jesus Christ and God. Certainly, I think there may have been a few deists, but I think they were probably in a very strong minority. Most of the people who came to America came here because they were Christians and wanted to escape the persecution of Christians that existed both in Great Britain and in France. The Huguenots, French Huguenots, came here as staunch Christians, and of course the Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Puritans. They were all sects of Christianity. We certainly were founded as a Christian nation.
Well, it's interesting, too, that Washington, at least for the historical record that survives, which is pretty robust, Washington was more Christian when he did speak about a specific religion as opposed to the divine hand of providence or some more poetic phrasing. He was actually more Christian in his public statements, again, than he was in his private statements. And we don't have all of his private statements. He and Martha Washington attempted to destroy. They missed a few, but they basically destroyed almost all of their private correspondence. So you have to acknowledge there is a gap in the historical record of private correspondence. But for the private correspondence that survives, Washington is less frequently specific about Christianity than he is in his public speeches or public correspondence, which again says something about the role that he thought the public man, the general or the president of a legislator, should play in government.
How different that is from Jefferson. Apparently most of his material is fairly well preserved. And of course, with Jefferson, his view towards Christianity had kept changing, you know, and I think towards the end he really returned to the religion of his youth. But of course, there was a time in his life when, of course, he was involved in many other things other than typical Christianity. But, I think that we all go through phases in our life, and many times as we grow older, while we mature, and we recognize, of course, the fallacy of some of the things we believed in before. Well, as far as George Washington was concerned, would you like to give some of the other examples of what you found as you went through his speeches, certainly his inaugural speeches, last speech, of course, when he left, and you've already quoted from that. Overall, certainly, there's no question at all that he repeatedly referred to Providence, the hand of God, or many other references he had to the fact that there really is a supreme being.
Well, you know, some examples I would add, and ones that come to mind go to Washington's care for people's religious differences, really, not often vast differences, but meaningful differences nonetheless. And I think, for example, of his treatment of captured British troops when he was in charge of the American Army fighting against the British Army. He actually took care to move British prisoners of war around in ways that he didn't have to, and really probably didn't want to as a military tactical matter, but he moved them around so that they could worship in their preferred way, just out of respect for their religious liberty, in essence, their natural right of religious liberty. He also, as I did mention earlier, urged respect for Roman Catholics, which was not common in the day, or at least not necessary, I would say, in his position. He also faced the problem repeatedly of the Quakers, who were pacifists, wanting to be exempt from the draft. And he had to decide how to deal with them. And in every respect, Washington was a very practical man, and his approach to life and any particular issue is very practical. So it was a close to the Quakers and their desire to be exempt from the draft because they were pacifists and were going to refuse to fight, he did not take a doctrinaire approach one way or another. He more or less required them to be drafted, but then went light on them in punishment. You know, he could have literally had them executed. He could have had them whipped for disobeying this obviously all-important law that the able-bodied men fight for the country. He didn't do that. He believed that only the good, only a good faith religious prerogative should be respected. It wasn't like anybody could get away with anything, and in fact, he suspected some Quakers of being spies for the British, and he did disrupt what were otherwise religious meetings when he thought that they were being used to spy for the British, so he wasn't going to take a religious excuse for misbehavior. But, on the other hand, when he did see what he believed to be a good faith, religious assertion of conscience against what would otherwise be a law that required someone to do something against that religious conscience, he went light on people or excused them from their obligation.
And I think that's really is a very important issue. He was a very compassionate man, and he really, of course, believed that people had a right to their religious beliefs, even if he didn't necessarily agree with them, and specifically with the Quakers and their refusal to fight or even to help the military. Before we go on, I'd like you to get your website out, and I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book, Under God. Very, very readable and excellent book.
Well, thank you very much. The title of the book, again, is Under God, George Washington and the Question of Church and State. The authors are Joseph Smith, that's me, and Tara Roth, who's my co-author, and those who have are either familiar with or have memberships or something on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. You can get the book there. Just search for George Washington, Church and State. Should be the first book that pops up, and you can order it that way. If you're interested in the best price, though, you will get it by going directly to our publisher's website, and they offer half price for anyone who orders directly from them. And that the book is available there at SpencePublishing.com. That's S-P-E-N-C-E Publishing.com. It's the top featured book at this time, so it'll pop right up for you. And as I say, that's the best price, but those who are more familiar with Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com can easily find it there.
All right, fine. And of course, we do a number of interviews with Spence Publishing, and certainly they're very, very good for doing business with. Anyway, of course, our guest this evening is Joseph Smith. We're talking about his story of George Washington, the book Under God. And certainly his name is Joseph Smith. He's the co-author of the book. And you really get a feeling of, you know, tremendous respect for this man. Certainly at one time, when you were growing up, you always heard about George Washington, who you know, chopped down the cherry tree and admitted to it because he couldn't tell a lie. And yet, of course, he really was a bigger-than-life figure. Of course, in real life, he must have been, what, 6'4", 6'5", something like that?
I think, yes, I should know that off the top of my head, so to speak, but I think about 6'4", 6'5". Yeah, something like that.
And anyway, he was a towering figure. He was a great military leader, and his men, of course, respected him, loved him. And, of course, his thesis was, we want moral Christian soldiers. And he really would not put up with any sort of misbehavior on the part of the military. And I think it was that sense of discipline and camaraderie, of course, that carried them through the Revolutionary War. Are there any other important points that you'd like to make as we draw our program to the close?
Well, you know, I think many Americans don't know where this idea, this phrase, the wall of separation between church and state, where it comes from. And in fact, I think many Americans think that the Constitution itself refers to a separation of church and state, which of course it does not. That phrase comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote more than 10 years after the First Amendment to the Constitution, which is what addresses religion, more than 10 years after the First Amendment was enacted. And it's interesting to step back into that history, and it's part of what we do in our book, is point out that, you know, Jefferson and Washington had political differences. Jefferson and Adams, who was the second president, and then Jefferson was the third, Jefferson and Adams had political differences. Among them was the fact that Jefferson did not like the fact that Washington is the first president, then Adams is the second president, had both declared days of public prayer and thanksgiving. Jefferson wanted to put an end to that, and he did, in fact, put an end to it in his administration. He also took the opportunity, that is, Jefferson did, in 1802, to write a letter to one particular religious group in Connecticut who had asked about religious liberty. And that's when Jefferson said that he thought there was a wall of separation between church and state. And that's where that language comes from. And it was picked up by the U.S. Supreme Court many decades later, first in the late 1880s, so what, 80 years later, and then again in the middle of the 20th century, another 60 or so years later, 70 years later. And that has what, that's what's become the courts.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, but certainly wasn't the phrase separation of church and state meaning that the federal government would have no say over the church, but that did not necessarily mean that the church could not try to influence the government. Did he believe it was an absolute wall?
You're asking now about Jefferson?
You're right.
No, and in fact, what's interesting is Jefferson has a very mixed record on the question of relationship between religion and government and what's really happened over time. I mean, Jefferson did have a more antagonistic relationship with the politically active clergy in the day. Jefferson, when he ran for president, was accused, probably falsely, but accused of being an atheist, and he was that contentious with the religiously active clergy that people thought they could accuse him of being an atheist. So he was on a different side of the political spectrum, especially on this issue, than Washington or Adams. But all that said, shortly after, Jefferson wrote his now famous letter saying there was a wall of separation between church and state, he went to a religious service in the United States Capitol building. He attended. And his otherwise a very mixed record. He never again, after that one letter, publicly, I mean, to the extent we know, never again advocated this supposed wall of separation between church and state. But what has happened somehow in modern times is that groups that you mentioned earlier, like the ACLU or the Americans for, I forget their name exactly, but separation of church and state, they've picked up on that phrase, as has the U.S. Supreme Court, and these groups now argue for this absolutist position of secularizing America in every way possible based on this one little snippet from one letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote 10 years after the First Amendment was ratified. So he didn't share this thought during the debates, during the drafting of the First Amendment. He wasn't there at the time. He wasn't there at the Constitutional Convention. He instead had some political motives for drafting that. He was a very artful writer, it's a clever phrase, and it got picked up decades and decades later by the courts as an authoritative interpretation of the First Amendment.
I really think, of course, this was because they wanted to change America from a Christian nation into a secular nation, and they needed an excuse, and that was the excuse. I don't think anybody in their right mind believed there really was a wall of separation, else they would not have opened the Supreme Court every day with the phrase, God save the United States and this honorable court. Anyway, we're out of time, Joseph. It's been a fascinating time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good night, and God bless.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope you enjoyed the conversation with Joseph Smith. I think it's important to understand the foundations of our freedom. And, of course, we have a four-tape set by that title. We actually have a wonderful book. It's called Betrayed by the Bench. It's written by John Stormer. And it goes into the background of the Supreme Court's decision to take God and the Ten Commandments and any reference to the divine and to the founder of the universe, our Lord, out of our schools, out of public places, out of government. And you have to understand that they had a motivation, and of course we tell you what that motivation was in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And we also tell you that motivation in our recent talk entitled The Planned Police State. Because, of course, if you can destroy the religious foundation of this nation, why, we will become a dictatorship, and I believe we're moving in that direction very rapidly. Let me suggest my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, our talk. It's on DVD, called The Planned Police State. We'll actually see the footage from the Iran-Contra hearings, where, of course, Congressman Jack Brooks is trying to bring out the fact in 1988 that there was a plan at that time, in case of a national emergency, to suspend habeas corpus, suspend the Constitution, round up Americans and put them into concentration camps. A fascinating interchange, and then, of course, Congressman Henry Gonzalez talking about the fact that what Congressman Jack Brooks said was true. There really was a plan in 1988, and that plan is even closer today. In fact, we have given the Kellogg-Brown and Root, a subdivision of Dick Cheney's Halliburton Corporation, $385 million to stand by, prepared at any time to begin building concentration camps in America. Why would you build concentration camps in America? Why would you put out that money? I mean, is this for the illegal aliens? No. It is for the American citizens, because there is a plan for a dictatorship as we turn away from our heritage of freedom under God, to become an authoritarian society under an elite that has a different worldview, an elite that is dedicated to the idea of a new world order, a new world religion, and, of course, a new world leader. So you really, of course, need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, our talk on the planned police state, and you really want to get the syllabus that goes with that. And then to put this into its spiritual perspective, you need to get the talk entitled Forbidden Secret. And, of course, that comes along with a syllabus. We recommend that you get that so you can actually read the president's inaugural addresses in 2001 and again in 2005, as he talks about the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm. The angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm. He uses the phrase twice at the conclusion of his first inaugural address. Why would George Bush raise that issue? Who is the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs his storm? And you'll find it a fascinating talk. The Forbidden Secret. It will help you to understand what's going on today, and perhaps why we're really fighting over in Iraq, because we certainly didn't go over there because we were intent upon protecting Saddam Hussein from using weapons of mass destruction on America. We were not under any threat at all. They had a different agenda, a different reason for going into Iraq. And, of course, if you have not yet seen our talk on Iraq, the untold story, and got that syllabus, that's very important, too, because much of the documentation, original documentation, we'll never find elsewhere, is in the talk, Iraq, the untold story. Or, and of course, we also have a slightly different one, but basically the same talk, War, the untold story, and then the Iraq, the untold story syllabus, where you get the documentation for everything we say. You need to have the documentation. You need to understand we're in a spiritual battle for the souls of men. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back in a moment. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Ted Gunderson, who was formerly the head of the FBI office in Los Angeles. I think he was some 26 years with the FBI before he retired and set up his own private investigation office. And then, of course, he's been involved in so many of the major cases of modern times, and investigating the case of certainly the Green Beret captain, Jeff McDonald, who has been in prison for 26 years. To cover up a satanic crime. Of course, Ted did a lot of the research on which is used in the book The Ultimate Evil, going into the background of some of the satanic rituals and crimes that were carried out in Southern California, associated with the movie industry there, and then the McMartin child school case there, where of course the children claimed that they were being used for satanic rituals. But tonight I've asked Ted to come on and talk about an article that has appeared recently in the Globe magazine, suggesting that Congressman Sonny Bono, remember Sonny Bono, Sonny and Cher? Well, of course, Sonny Bono eventually became a congressman. He was a good congressman. He was doing a great job. And then, of course, suddenly he dies on the ski slopes, supposedly, just ran into a tree. Well, of course, I think anybody who knows the background knows this is not what happened. And, of course, my friend Bob Fletcher has done a lot of research on this. In fact, he had talked to Sonny Bono, given him a good deal of information, and Sonny had promised that as soon as he got through with his skiing trip, he was going to go back to Congress and open an investigation into some of the corruption that Bob Fletcher had been able to document and the dossier had given Sonny Bono. But, of course, he died on the ski slopes. Well, of course, who has done the investigation on this? But once again, our good friend Ted Gunderson. So I'm going to let him tell you what he discovered, what really was all about. I think it's very interesting that the Globe magazine now has come forward with an article. And you can get this referred to up on the Internet. Just Google in Globe magazine, Sonny Bono. You'll see the references to it. But you don't want to get the second or third-hand reports. You want to get the report from the man who actually investigated this and worked with Bob Fletcher on the strange death of Sonny Bono. Go ahead, Ted. Good to have you with us again.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, it's always a great pleasure to be on your show. You're one fantastic individual. I saw your recent lecture on video, on DVD, actually, that you gave in Orange County and also, I think, in Granada Forum in Ventura County, San Fernando Valley, California. You were fantastic. You're great. The information you have furnished to the public has to be far and wide as much as possible to as many Americans as we can get it to. But in this particular instance, I think the glory and the credit really goes to Bob Fletcher. Bob, as you said, was in contact with Sonny Bono's, one of his associates in Washington, D.C. He sent him a report, and as a result of sending this report, it was read by Sonny Bono when he was a congressman there. And the congressman, I think, do I hear music, Doctor?
You do hear music. We're going to be going to break in just about 40 seconds. Go ahead. I'll let you know what you have to stop.
Anyway, he sent the report to the administrative assistant for Congressman Bono. Congressman Bono read it. And as you said a few moments ago, he said as soon as he returned from his vacation, this holiday vacation in 1998, he was going to look into this, issue subpoenas, and find out the facts, the truth behind the whole situation. This involved large-scale drug operations.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Ted, go ahead, pick the story up.
Well, of course, 10 days later, unfortunately, on January 5, 1998, Sonny Bono, allegedly an expert skier, 62 years old, was not killed by crashing into a tree, as the official report said. He was skiing at Heavenly Ski Resort in Nevada. He was killed based on Bob Fletcher's autopsy and analysis. And Bob Fletcher, as I said, deserves a lot of credit for this. And he was savagely clubbed to death by professional hitmen. As far as I'm concerned, the killers were working for international drug and arms dealers whose sinister ties with U.S. government officials were about to be exposed by Bono. He was going to issue a number of subpoenas. He was going to get to the bottom of this. And the savage murders were covered up by making it look like an accident. And after reviewing the secret documents, the official version of Sonny Bono's death, as far as I'm concerned, is absolutely ridiculous. It's nonsense. For anyone to now try to suggest that Bono died after crashing into a tree is unbelievable, particularly after you review the autopsy report and all the details of the situation. There's zero evidence in this autopsy report or any other official documents to show that an accident happened. Instead, there's powerful proof he was actually assassinated. This is an evil plot. It's carried out by almost perfection by, obviously, ruthless assassins. Now, of course, we have the tragic death, and the body must be exhumed, and I've seen this, I said this in the article, and for more details. And the case must be reopened immediately and treated as a homicide investigation. I'm not alone in my analysis of this. A forensic pathologist, Robert Goldberg, told the Globe magazine in the article that the death should be handled as a criminal case by authorities from the get-go and not as a skiing accident. Here's a quote. The first thing you do is look at every case with a jaundiced eye until the crime is ruled out as a possibility, he said. Now, the evidence, Dr. Stan, points to murder was, as I said, gathered by Bob Fletcher. Bob is 66 years old. He spent a decade working on the case. He also feels partly responsible, of course, for what happened because he did send this report to Sonny Bono's administrative assistant. Bono did read the report. And Fletcher, in this report, points out and the activities of high-ranking U.S. military and government officials he claims were making millions in from arms and drug deals in Central America and Southeast Asia. This ties right into our McDonald case, by the way, Doctor.
Do you think there was a spiritual element to this, a satanic element to it, or what?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it, because in my investigation of Dr. McDonald's murders on February 17, 1970, it was a satanic murder.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ted Gunderson. And, of course, basically what had happened is that Bob Fletcher, who is in his 60s, we've had Bob on frequently. We have some of his great DVDs we offer, one on weather modification, one on the New World Order, certainly one on UFOs. And although I disagree with his interpretation, there's no question when you watch that DVD that there really are UFOs out there. The only question is, what are they? But certainly good friends can differ, as to what the UFOs are, I believe. Of course, they're spiritual manifestations, they're demonic manifestations. Bob believes they're from another planet. It doesn't matter. The fact that they're real, and there's an effort to confuse the American public and to lie to them about what these manifestations are. But Bob had also, of course, been investigating drugs and arms smuggling at the highest levels of our government. He had prepared a report. He'd given it to Sonny Bono's aides, Sonny Bono, who had read it, and said as soon as he got back from his vacation, of course, he was going to look into these charges. Of course, he, being a congressman, he was able to actually call a congressional committee. He could subpoena people to come. And that was the last thing that these people wanted. And so Sonny Bono died on the ski slopes. And, of course, Ted Gunderson's gone over his report. Ted, what was it about the investigation at that time? Did they do an autopsy on the body? And where were the blows? Certainly, if he ran into a tree, the blows should have been from in front.
Well, actually, his widow, Mary, went on, to win the congressional seat and later remarried, announced the tragedy was likely caused by her husband popping prescription painkillers, but the results of the autopsy report later ruled out that possibility, say the experts. It shows that the famous politician had no booze or illegal drugs in his system, and he had taken a therapeutic dose of What is it called?
Anti-inflammatory medication.
Yes, medication.
Go ahead.
Catastrophic injuries have never been disclosed, and to this day, Douglas County officials have refused to make the autopsy report public.
Now, why would that be? I mean, here's a public figure. Who was it who refused to actually release the autopsy report?
Well, the Douglas County officials have refused to do
that. Why would they do that unless they're trying to cover up something?
Well, that's my personal and professional opinion of it, Doctor. But Bob Fletcher obtained a copy of the sealed autopsy results. I understand he obtained it from one of his relatives, one of Sonny Boner's relatives. Maybe his mother, who also all along has thought that he was murdered, and also other documents linked to his death. And I had a number of journalists who attempted to obtain a copy of this autopsy report, and unsuccessful. So, you know, hats off to Bob Fletcher. And his wife, Mary, reported him missing at 4:30 that afternoon, and the ski patrol found his bloody body at 7:45 that night. The report describes Bono with traumatic facial injuries and lying on his right side with his right arm around a tree and his ski still attached to his boots. But Fletcher says a skier crashing into a tree would be knocked back. This is in the article, by the way. And meanwhile, the five-page autopsy report by then-Washoe County pathologist Dr. David Palisari determined the cause of death was cranial cerebral injuries due to blunt trauma force, a skiing accident, of course. Now, you're a doctor. You know a lot about that, Doctor.
Certainly wasn't a pathologist, but certainly a cerebral accident, a cerebral injury. But you would expect, of course, that he would try to protect his face. And the last thing it would be running into a tree. And some other prominent person had run into a tree just a few weeks before and had died. So this was the second one. But the story never quite made sense. I mean, Bono was an excellent skier. He certainly could have avoided a tree. And so what really did happen?
Well, they claim that he was skiing at approximately 30 miles an hour off the trail. I'm kind of wondering how he got off the trail. I don't know if that's normal or not for a skier. But other injuries detailed in the documentation included a black eye, a swollen lip, bloody nose, bruised jaw, and two upper teeth knocked out on the right side of his head. And the pathologist also noted a series of small fractures in the central depressed region on the right side of Bono's skull and found some of the fractured bone pieces had a curved configuration. Now, Fletcher consulted a panel of experts and performed a recreation to determine how these wounds were caused. He concluded the depression areas was due to blows from a round-edged weapon wielded by a man taller than 5'9", 165, politician, and the killer. Was left-handed. The killer was left-handed, since the wounds were on his right side of Bono's face and head. He also believed there was a second man that held Bono from behind, and he thinks that the murder weapon was a pistol. But other experts tell Globe that the gun barrel would have left distinguishable marks. Now, Sonny was apparently ambushed, viciously battered to death with a billy club or a similar weapon, as far as I can tell. And then the killer staged a crime scene and made it look like a tragic ski accident. Now, Fletcher insists the lack of damage to the back of the Bono's head, known as contra coup injuries, is proof that he was beaten to death. He says that people who hit objects face first normally have brain injuries caused with the organ rebound off the back of their skull, and other physical evidence doesn't add up, he also said. This is in the article. Strangely, what was called a ski accident, Bono had no smashed ribs, no broken knees, no neck trauma or head injuries that would have come from trying to ward off a collision with the tree. And Bob Fletcher says that the signs that he actually hit the tree, including bark impressions on his face and plant debris on his clothes, were also missing. And also, it was kind of interesting because he had blood on the back of his jacket. It was soaked with blood, as a matter of fact. And yet he had no wounds on his back. So I think that the blood must have come from someone else, perhaps when Sonny valiantly fought back and hit one of his assailants. Now, somebody should, I don't know what's happened to those clothes, but somebody should have done DNA on those clothes. This obviously was covered up. And also, the autopsy mentioned a small L-shaped tear on the back of Ona's black and blue ski jacket. Fletcher says the tear is likely the result of a struggle. And I believe the new evidence gathered by Fletcher raises a specter of murder and warrants a new investigation. This is a cover-up. It has lasted for 10 years. It's time for the truth to come out, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think I'm glad that the Globe magazine has published the article, and I think it's important the American people understand that this sort of thing really does go on in America. We carry a book called Drugging America, and of course it's written by the author of Defrauding America and Unfriendly Skies, and of course it goes into the background of the involvement of the CIA in drugs. We also carry a book called Into the Buzzsaw, where of course Gary Webb writes one of the articles. He was the Pulitzer Prize winning author that worked for the San Jose Mercury, who talked and wrote about the CIA involvement in drug smuggling. And Gary Webb, after being fired from the San Jose Mercury because somebody put pressure on them, Gary Webb eventually committed suicide by shooting himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. An amazing, amazing story. If they can convince the American people of that, they can probably convince the American people that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman, that Saran was able, standing in front of Bobby Kennedy, to have shot him from behind, because those were the bullets from behind that killed. And there were 14 bullets, and only 8 bullets, of course, in Saran's gun. But 14 bullets were fired, and then, of course, James Earl Ray were to believe that he killed Martin Luther King. Seems that they use these same cover stories over and over again, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I use the term that they've been suicided. You know, Gary Webb is the perfect example of that. He lived alone, and he had this exposed to drugs coming into South Central L.A. by the CIA. And he was shot, as you said, twice in the head. The one bullet took off his jaw, or was shot through his jaw. And I suspect that what he did was he tried to defend himself, and before the assassin pulled the bullet or pulled the trigger, he deflected his arm, and that's what shot him in the jaw, and then of course a shot to the head. Now, Gary Webb was Catholic, and he left a note for his children. And what he said in the note was, "Don't worry, God will let me in." Now, that's a subliminal message, as far as I'm concerned, because in the Catholic religion, if you commit suicide, you don't go to heaven. And I think he was telling his children that he will be going to heaven because he did not commit suicide. And, of course, then we have, as you said, Bobby Kennedy. We have, you know, I think there's another interesting facet here, Dr. Stan. I think Jack Kennedy Jr., there's a highly suspicious plane crash on that. You know, he was, as I understand, was going to run for the Senate in New York State, and he certainly would have beat out Hillary Clinton by a landslide, I believe, because of the popularity of his father. And so he had this mysterious plane crash. That's not, these cases are not being properly investigated because of high-placed government officials involved in these satanic cults, Doctor. You know, you and I have been on the show together several times, and you're the one person that understands that this is a spiritual war. This is a war between good and evil, and it's satanic. The evil is satanic, and it's very, very common. We're talking at about 50 to 60,000 human sacrifices a year. We're talking about at least 4 million Americans who are practicing Satanists in this country today.
And I think that really is such an unusual idea that there really would be Satanists practicing here in this country, and that it would be covered up. But why doesn't the media tell us? Well, of course, because many of the people in the media are tied into this. And, of course, really, you only need to note that there are literally, thousands of people who disappear every year. Thousands of people disappear, and most of them are never found. Where are they? What happened to the bodies? Would there really be satanic sacrifices going on in the United States, satanic ceremonies, and we'd never hear about them? Well, you really need to get the video on the Bohemian Grove, and you'll see certainly satanic ceremonies with the black robes and all. We'll go right ahead, Ted.
Well, the first step in the Sonny Bono case should be to exhume the body. And there's got to be some evidence on the body that would help to determine whether or not he was murdered. I'm convinced he was murdered. And in my opinion, it isn't necessary to exhume the body, but it is necessary to prove it and to document it. And it's kind of interesting because I had a call from Washington, D.C. today. The American Free Press people called me. And one of the ladies in American Free Press was driving to work today, and it was announced on the radio in Washington, D.C. I then called the Associated Press. I called the L.A. Times. I called the Desert Sun in Palm Springs, where Sonny Bono was a congressman. And I tipped them about this story in Globe magazine, and I suggested that they call me. And also, of course, if they read the Globe magazine, they can contact Bob Fletcher. Bob Fletcher, as I said, is the hero of this story. All I did was come along and analyze it. But and also received a call from Thailand. A fellow named Gordon Savell, S-I-V-E-L-L, is writing a book. He is taken up where Danny Casolaro left off. Danny Casolaro is another individual who was suicided, of course, in West Virginia. He was writing a book called The Octopus, and he was tying in all the loose ends of this nefarious, evil, covert government criminal element that's active in our system today and in our government today. And Danny was doing this, and of course he was murdered. He got too close. I had a call from Danny. He called me on a regular basis about a week before he was murdered. And anyway, this Gordon Savell is following up with Danny's work, and he called me to tell me that this Globe story about Sonny Bono's death and probable murder, as far as I'm concerned, he was murdered, is being reported in the mainstream in Australia. Now, wouldn't you think, Dr. Stan, that it would be reported in the mainstream here, even though it's from the Globe magazine? But, you know, people say, oh, that's a rag. That's the trash. It isn't trash, because these people have to be very careful. If they do not report the facts as they are, and they don't have it documented, then they're subject and liable for lawsuits. So there you have it. As far as I'm concerned, I think we're looking at another major cover-up, not only by officials as far as Sonny Bono is concerned, but also by the news media.
And, of course, none of those papers that you contact were interested at all in looking into the story anymore?
Well, I also called the Associated Press, and I left word on their... They all have voicemails. And I left word on the voicemails to tip them about this. And I haven't heard back from them. I gave them my cell phone, so they could reach me immediately. And that's it. I mean, I think it'll be another cover-up. It's been covered up for 10 years now, so there's no reason to think otherwise.
Well, I think we have certainly a few magazines out there, a few tabloids that will carry these stories, and everybody sees them, and, oh, well, that's the Globe, you know, that's the National Enquirer, and yet sometimes they will carry things that you'll never read elsewhere. In fact, as I remember, wasn't it one of the editors of National Enquirer who got one of those anthrax letters?
It was the people at Globe and National Enquirer.
Right. Isn't it interesting? They got the anthrax letters, and none of them went to Republicans. Two Democratic senators got them, but no Republicans got them. I wonder why.
Yes. That's right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is Ted Gunderson. He mentioned, of course, this is really on the cutting edge of things. It was just fortuitous we were able to get Ted onto our program. We just heard about this story in Globe yesterday, and, of course, it was yesterday, wasn't it, Ted?
Yes, it came out, I think, last Thursday.
All right,
today
fine,
is what, Monday, Tuesday?
The Ted had actually then called the AP, had called the newspaper in the town where Sonny lived, called several other major media, told them about this story in the Globe. Stories being carried overseas, but totally blocked out here in the United States. They do not want the people to know the truth, any more than they want them to know the truth about the murder of Martin Luther King. The hypocrisy here this last week, when, of course, they were celebrating the 40th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King, And of course, there was a trial. There was a trial that was put and actually is brought against a man named Lloyd Showers by Martin Luther King's family, and they accused him of being involved with the murder. And Lloyd Showers admitted he was part of a planned program to kill Martin Luther King. There was a hitman. The CIA was involved. There was an army sniper team. And all this was brought out at the trial. Lloyd Showers confessed he had been given $100,000 by the member of the CIA to actually allow his restaurant, which was called Jim's Place, right across the street from the Lorraine Hotel there in Memphis. And that's where the murder plan for Martin Luther King was laid out. Sidney James Earl Ray was the patsy, that the murderer was a professional hitman. Hiding in a brush across the street there, adjacent to the Jim's Place. And of course, before Lloyd Showers died, he actually gave a videotaped confession, which was played at the trial. And the jury found that the government was, 70% involved. The CIA was 70% involved in the murder of Martin Luther King. Now, how could you have a trial like that in the United States and not a word in the controlled media? Why, of course, we have freedom of the press. If you own the press, you have the freedom not to tell the story. We do actually have a book called An Affair of State, written by William Pepper, who is the lawyer who actually solved the crime. It's An Affair of State. It's available from Radio Liberty. You're not going to, of course, get this at your regular bookstores, I suspect. Incidentally, we just had Herman calling in from Carmel, pointing out that our churches today very seldom talk about evil. They very seldom talk about Satanism or satanic cults. It's almost as if we remove that from the lexicon, not only of the major media, and certainly from our police forces, but certainly from our churches as well. And of course, the most tragic thing, and Ted has brought this out, is that there are people within the CIA, pardon me, within the FBI, if there's a question about a satanic crime, they always send somebody out from the FBI to play down the idea. Is that really true, Ted? Does the FBI try to discourage people from, and the police forces from believing in satanic crimes and satanic rituals and satanic murders?
Well, this is the case in the past. On the McMartin preschool case, the children claimed that they were taken down into the tunnels under the school and up into a trap door, the triplex next door, and then taken out into the community and prostituted 2-, 3-, 4-year-old children. These are preschool children. And the fellow named Ken Lanning at that time, now this would have been in the 1980s, he was on the behavioral science unit of the FBI in Quantico, Virginia. And of course, when the law enforcement has a crime and there's some question about where did it come from, what are the sources, and so forth, they in the past have looked to the FBI for the leadership and for guidance and for the answer. And in the past, they've gone to the behavioral science unit of the FBI. Ken Lanning was one of the individuals there. And Ken Lanning has publicly stated, at least back in the 1980s, when I was following his career, I think he's retired since then, that there are no satanic cults. There are just a few dabblers out there scribbling on the wall, and that is absolutely ridiculous. The McMartin case was all about satanic cults, and the children said that there was a 9-foot chamber. They didn't know how big it was. We found out it was 9 foot because I hired an archaeologist, and there was a 9-foot chamber under the school. And I think there's some more music, Doctor.
Yes, I'm afraid that is, we're going to have to take another break, but this is the McMartin school case, and I'll never forget how the Wall Street Journal started to poo-poo this and a great miscarriage of justice. What a terrible thing to send these the McMartin family to prison, because, of course, they weren't guilty at all. It was all an exaggeration. And yet, of course, Ted investigated this and found that there was a great deal to corroborate the stories of the children, but the American people must never be allowed to know there really are satanic organizations in America today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, our guest this evening, Ted Gunderson, and he's been on the front line of so many of these investigations, and we were just talking about how when the McMartin preschool case was brought to the attention of the public, and of course, it was publicized by the media, how, of course, the FBI sent their expert out to play down the idea that there really was any satanic elements, satanic crimes. Ted, reading at these figures, how many actually people disappear every day? How many children disappear and are never found every day?
Well, Dr. Stan, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is an adjunct of the U.S. Department of Justice, I might mention, has on their website that 91 Americans disappear every hour. I suspect after the show today it'll be dropped considerably because they don't want this exposed. And of these 91 Americans who disappear every hour, Doctor, it's estimated between 85 and 90% of them are children. Now, what I'm telling you is I have solid, chiseled in stone documentation that the CIA has been involved in kidnapping children since the early 1960s. I have a report called The Finders, and the organization, the name of the organization they use is The Finders. And this report contains a report from the Bureau of Customs Agent, Department of Treasury. And in this report, it started out in Tallahassee, Florida, where somebody called in anonymously and said there were two well-dressed men, I think it was five or six children, shabbily dressed in a park there. The police in Tallahassee, Florida went down, talked to the children that didn't know how to use telephones, didn't know how to use toilets. They were ages 2 to 6, as I recall. And they said they were en route to a smart school in Mexico. The police in Tallahassee, Florida then notified the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. The Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. issued a search warrant for the Finders headquarters. And what they found in the Finders headquarters is shocking. They found information about the international trafficking of children all over the world. Hong Kong, China, Europe, Asia, every country basically in the world. And these kids were being kidnapped and shipped overseas. There's no question about it. They also found information about terrorist activity that was taking place around the world. And this was investigated internally. Now, the customs agent, the last day that he decided that he would get a final briefing on it.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Ted. I really want our listeners to hear all of this. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ted was just saying that, that according to the center where they actually track missing people, 91 people disappear in the United States every hour. 91 people, and of course the majority of them are children. Many of them, of course, are used for human sacrifices. And of course, he was telling us about the Finders. The Finders group is a special group of where these perverted people work. And of course, he has a report on them. And who actually did this report? Was this a customs agent who did the report, or who did the report, Ted?
Yes, Dr. Stan, it was a report by the Department of Treasury, a customs agent. And this report, and this agent went out for a final briefing, and he was told by an official of the Metropolitan Police Department that the report that they had been classified top secret, was not available for review. The FBI told the Metropolitan Police Department that they could not, headquarters did, that they could not notify the FBI field office, which conducts investigation in Washington, D.C. Headquarters is Domestic Intelligence Division. They could not notify the field office. And the State Department said that the passports that were found in the car, which showed travel to North Korea and Russia, that the State Department said that this was in the 1950s and 60s, that this was legitimate travel. Well, we were not allowed to travel in those countries at that time. And so it was a major, major cover-up.
Now, what was the Finders group? Was this some sort of a group of perverts who were taking children and shipping them all over the world after kidnapping them in here?
This was an organized CIA operation, and the reason I know it was CIA, because the final briefing by this customs agent In addition to telling him it was classified top secret and they could not get him, would not give him a report, he was told that the investigation would be conducted internally by the CIA. And there was an article in U.S. News and World Report several years later, and there were two congressmen, one from Florida and one from North Carolina, who said that they were going to look into this. And I checked the records to try to find them, to interview them, and I learned that they were no longer in Congress, which is not surprising at all. Yeah. So the Finders is involved in... Look, I talked to a fellow named Paul Benassi, who was part of the network. He was used... out of the Nebraska Franklin cover-up case, he was used as a decoy in shopping centers, malls, and so forth, to track children his age, 10, 11, 12 years old, over to a car where two adults would grab the kids, throw them in the back seat, and Paul and another kid would put chloroform over their face, and they would be knocked out, of course, in no time at all. Paul gave me a five-hour interview on mind control. He's a mind control victim. Paul told me, and this is on my videotape, by the way, it's a DVD, it's available to you folks, by the way, that he'd been to three such locations where there were auctions, Las Vegas, barn in Lincoln, Nebraska, outside Lincoln, Nebraska, and Toronto, Canada. And there were as few as six and as many as 36 children who were auctioned off. They would put the children anywhere from ages 2 up to 21 on a stage with a number around their neck, and people would bid on the number. And, of course, the kids were in underwear, boys and girls. And in the Las Vegas instance, he said that they were placed on an airplane and flown out of here, and there were men with turbans at the airport who bid on these kids. So, obviously, they went to the Middle East. And, by the way, I might mention that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, I checked their budget, and they received something like $49 million in donations year before last. I haven't checked recently on it.
All right, now, let's go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get your material, because you've got a lot of videos, a lot of DVDs, a lot of reports. How can they get the Finder's Report and some of the other things you're talking about?
Dr. Stan, now, unfortunately, my website is down, but if you make a note of it, tedgunderson.com, I'm trying to get it up now. My webmaster was recently convicted of a crime which he did not commit, and I'm trying to get to him. He's in jail. Trying to get to him to get the password to get the website back up. I rather strongly suspect cyber terrorism by some element within the government, possibly National Security Agency. And but anyway, if you will be patient, write this down. Check in a week or so. TedGunderson.com. I have numerous written reports, including the Finder's Report. I have a book called The Franklin Cover-Up, which I think you're going to be carrying very shortly, Dr. Stan.
We will.
And also I have a report, I have a book called The Pawns in the Game. It's available. It explains this whole situation. And also I have, and I give away, 400 free DVDs for shipping and handling. And what I charge is $3 and I think 80 some cents per DVD. I give them away, folks. They're yours. They're free. Except all you have to do is pay shipping and handling. And I give them to you. I have 400 that I give away. And that's on a website called #1-free-DVD.com. That's #1-free-DVD.com. I can't do any more, Dr. Stan. I can't do any more than give my material away. And I live on a retirement, and I use the money that I get in my retirement in order to expose this evil element in the government. So if you want to send me a few extra dollars, I would certainly appreciate it, because right now I took my retirement money. To be honest with you, I'm not crybabying or anything. I have no money from now to the end of the month. And so I make about 50 cents per DVD, by the way. But I give these away. I want you folks to order them. And then my Finder's Report is available on tedgunderson.com. I'm trying desperately to get that site back up as soon as possible.
And is that one free, is it one free DVD? What is it?
It's #1-free-DVD. com.
All right, fine. Is that up working, or has they got that one down?
That's
too?
Working.
That's working. Okay, fine. So, Sydney, it's pretty hard to beat that as far as the price is concerned. Ted's certainly been on the front lines of this battle for a long time, as Bob Fletcher and myself, a handful of others trying to educate the people about what's going on. And most people say it couldn't be true. There couldn't be satanic crimes. It couldn't be satanic. You know, groups out there making sacrifices, human sacrifices. Well, of course, you need to get in the background of the Son of Sam murders. David Berkovich was part of a satanic cult. The government covered it up. Manson was part of a satanic cult. This was covered up. The Jeffrey McDonald murders, part of a satanic cult. The government covered it up. Why would they? Because there are satanic elements working at certain levels of our government. They're working within our intelligence agencies. Most people work for government are good people. But there is a small evil element out there. Until you can recognize that, you can't understand any of the things that are going on today any more than you can understand the sacrifice of almost 1 million Iraqi lives on just an accident. We just made a mistake. We never should have gone into Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction. But we'd do it all over again. A human sacrifice, 1 million people slaughtered for no purpose at all. But then, of course, that's the story of so many of the wars, over and over again, whether it be the 800,000 people who were Christians who were hacked to death in Rwanda, as our government did everything they could to prevent the United Nations from intervening. We had forces there. We had troops there. They could have stopped it immediately. And, of course, Kofi Annan, who at that time was in charge of the UN forces in Rwanda, ordered the UN troops not to intervene, as 800,000 Christians were hacked to death. Simply another example of these satanic forces at work in the world today. Well, of course, you know, this idea, you know, that there really could be these CIA kidnapping children, this was brought out very beautifully in a television series called The Pretender, about this young man who had been kidnapped by the CIA, and of course it had been used for all sorts of experiments, and developed his ability to think very effectively. And of course, see, week after week, there's always the program at the end, they're always trying to recapture him again. The Pretender, of course, it was based upon the truth, but everybody thought it was simply an interesting television program. Did you ever see that one, Ted?
No, I didn't. I just made a note of it. I'm going to see if I can get a hold of that.
They've taken it off, but it was on for a number of years. And
Was that a TV series?
It was a television series called The Pretender.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was really based upon the truth. And, of course, we've talked to Kathy O'Brien, who says that the claims, and I really believe her, that she was actually sold into by her father into the CIA because they had him on child abuse, child pornography, things of that sort. And so he simply turned her over to the CIA, got a nice settlement, financial settlement, good job from the CIA, and sold his daughter into sex slavery.
Well, same thing happened to Bryce Taylor, too, Doctor.
Whatever happened to Bryce, incidentally?
Bryce Taylor, I was with her on and off giving lectures, and also I spent 2 months on her couch in Las Vegas, sleeping on her couch with a gun because she'd taken her daughter out of the clutches of her husband, who she claimed was involved in satanic cults, through illegally, by the way, through the Child Protective Services, and she was afraid something was going to happen. So I slept on the couch for 2 months in Las Vegas with a gun. Excuse me, I'm sorry. And then I even prepared a nice Thanksgiving dinner for Bryce and her family and some other people. David Icke was there, by the way, from England. But she, in the meantime, she's kind of dropped out of sight. She moved to South Carolina. And I don't know what she's doing now. I rather suspect that she's obviously a mind control victim, MK-Ultra mind control victim. And I rather suspect that she's been reprogrammed. She broke away, and I think she's maybe been reprogrammed. I don't know what's happened to her. And she's back into the fold again, which they are going to do, of course.
And didn't she write a book called Thanks for the Memories, the story of Bob Hope, the real story of Bob Hope?
Yes, she did, Thanks for the Memories. And a number of other individuals, very prominent people, went right up to the White House, a number of congressmen and senators. And That's all in her book. And I had 35 copies of that book on consignment from Bryce, and it was stolen from me by a fellow named Stu Webb, who's an FBI informant. That's all documented, Doctor. Don't worry about a lawsuit. And it's kind of interesting what's happened to me, because I'm under attack. If you go on the Internet, somebody told me I'm on the Internet, I mentioned 183,000 times, and about 99% is favorable, 1% or maybe 2% is unfavorable. And this disinformation program has been directed at me to try to discredit me, because I am not an individual with a grocery cart looking for a recycling center. I'm a retired FBI chief, so...
Well, I think it's because I've heard all these stories about you, Ted, but I don't believe any of them. Then we get a chance to meet Ted at the conspiracy conference. Will you be there this year in June? It's going to be out in the Marriott Hotel in Santa Clara?
No, I don't. I can't afford to go to these conferences unless somebody pays my way, and unless I give a speech. And I've not been invited to give a lecture this year.
Don't feel bad. I wasn't asked either, but maybe next year we can do it together. I'll mention it to Brian Hall who puts those on.
I was at the Conspiracy Conference 2002 and 2006, and I think that Brian Hall, who runs the Conspiracy Conference, likes to have different lectures each year. But as knowledgeable as you and I are, Doctor, you should have us every year, because there's always going to be a few new people at these conferences. So.
Well, of course, there are a lot of really far-out people at the conference, but I go there because I believe there has to be a Christian voice. And if I'm not there, of course, all they're going to hear are the occult, and an awful lot of occultists and Satanists attend these conferences, but it's going to be in early June. We'll be giving more information on that, and we want the Christians there to, of course, try to counsel these people. Many of them are misled. They're looking for something, and of course, when they begin to realize there is a power out there they can tap into, they can give them, you know, love or whatever they're looking for, money, power, success, wealth. Why, of course, they'll tap into that without understanding that, of course, they're risking their eternal souls. Well, we've got Bruce who's calling from Spokane. We haven't asked for questions, but it's sort of the end of the program. Let's hear what Bruce has to say. Bruce, you have a question or comment?
Yes, I certainly like to thank you for having Ted Gunderson on. He's got a good history of being interested in what's going on in this nation. I've read something about the satanic crimes, and on your suggestion, I picked up the book, I think, by Mari Terry
Ultimate Evil, right?
On some of the, I think it was, I'm not sure what it was called, but it was about the Son of Sam, and it followed that one certain trail of the satanic crimes going through a lot of these criminal activities in America. I'd like to know if Ted Gunderson knows anything about satanic activities in the U.S. military.
Before I go on, though, I just want to mention, Bruce, that if you read the book The Ultimate Evil, you'll remember there was a story about a murder that was carried out in the hills of somewhere around Los Angeles. It tied into some things going on in Hollywood, and actually the person who did the research on that was none other than Ted Gunderson. But Sidney Bruce asks about Satanism in the military. Do you know anything about that at all?
Oh, of course, I know a lot about that. By the way, that was Roy Radin, the Hollywood producer who came out and was taken up into the hills of northern hills of Los Angeles and murdered by a fellow named Bill Mentzer, who's a satanic CIA contract killer, and three other people were with him. As far as the military is concerned, it's been infiltrated. One of the goals of the Illuminati is to infiltrate law enforcement and the military. I interviewed for 3 weeks up in the mountains in Colorado. I took her, she and her girlfriend and another friend, up into a cabin in Colorado. Interviewed them for 3 weeks back in mid-1980s, I guess it was. And her father was in the military. He was in military intelligence, the Army. And she told me that the U.S. Army is Satan's army.
I've seen some strange things in the military, and there's an internal clique that you can't get into unless you're basically a criminal yourself. And I've seen the people that are perverts rise to the top like nobody else can.
And I think, of course, what you have to understand is there's an element within the military who's trying to tap into the other dimension, and actually they have units within the military that are trying to tap into this Luciferian power, quite frankly. That's what it's about.
Dr. Stan, would you consider having Kay Griggs on as a guest?
Yes, yeah. Now, that's, I was going to mention her name,
okay,
Bruce.
Very good. I stumbled onto her, and I tried to follow everything she had to say in her story, too.
Yes, I would. I've talked to her in the past, and initially this story was so far out I was afraid to put her on, but the more I learn, the more I think that maybe
yeah,
it's telling the truth.
Isn't
so,
that the way it always is?
You can call me off the air, or you can leave her telephone number with my producer. We'll get her on. And, of course, her husband was high in the military.
Yes.
And, of course, she frowned about the satanic involvement, the things he was involved in, and she's been trying to bring it out, and the story.
And, of course, they threatened her life and have been chasing her ever since, trying to get hold of her diary.
And, of course, we need to get this information out. At least a few people in America will understand we're involved in the spirits about it, being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, but it's really a spiritual battle, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program tonight. Thanks so much, Bruce.
You bet, Bruce.
Good evening.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program, Ted.
Let's see, Doctor. Let me just repeat. We need to educate as many people as possible. You folks need to write down my website, tedgunderson.com. Hopefully I'll have it back up in about a week. And also, you need to write in and get my free DVDs. I have over 400 to choose from. It involves the exposure of satanic cults, exposure of corruption within the government, exposure of a covert operation that's active, and including special forces who are recruited by the CIA in order to become involved in as official assassins and in the CIA drug operation. And anyway, this is all documented in my DVDs, and it's number one, hyphen, free, F-R-E-E, hyphen, DVD.com.
No wonder they want to get you, Tom. I certainly, exposing what's going on today is not very popular, is it?
No, it's not very. Let me mention one other thing, Doctor. I'm in an apartment here in Los Angeles. It's and just within, just before your show, I heard some strange pumping in the bathroom next door. I went over and listened, and there were people over there talking about poison, and my eyes started burning, and I really suspect that somebody's pumping poison into the bathroom of this apartment house. You there?
Well, yes, I'm saying I wanted you to take care of yourself. Certainly, we always enjoy having you on, and we'll open up the windows there, whatever you can, to make sure that you're safe.
Well, I closed the door. And my eyes were burning when I was in there, so I don't think there's any question about it.
Okay, fine. Well, you take care of yourself, and because, of course, we don't have many people on the front lines who are willing to give everything in this battle to try to awaken the American people. There really are satanic cults, and we'll, of course, give our listeners more evidence of that when we wrap up the program. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners tonight, Ted?
Well, just educate yourself, folks, and get these free DVDs and give them to your friends. I mean, you can't ask for any better deal than that. 400 DVDs that exposes exactly what we're talking about here tonight.
Get the DVDs on the Jeff McDonald, the Green Beret captain who's been in prison for 25 years for a crime he didn't commit, accused of committing, of killing his wife and children. It was actually a satanic cult, and we know that, of course, they know that. Because other people involved had come forward. One of the marshals had taken a woman to see the prosecutor, who told the prosecutor, I was part of the satanic cult. And he told her to shut her mouth and never to reveal that publicly. Well, we're out of time. God bless. Good night. Take care, Dr. Stan.
Thanks.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris, this has been sort of a heavy program. We really were going to start out simply talking about Sonny Bono, but Of course, Ted's been at this for such a long time, and of course, the real story of Captain Jeffrey McDonald, a Green Beret officer whose family was murdered by a satanic cult, and certainly I have an article just recently where the marshal who had taken one of the members of the satanic cult to see the prosecutor told the prosecutor exactly what had happened. She'd been there, and he told her to keep quiet or he would prosecute her for murder, for her involvement in the murder. She was trying to let people know that Jeffrey McDonald was innocent, but they were covering for the satanic cult. and you want to get that information from Ted. Certainly, all sorts of clippings. Go up on the internet. Look up Captain Jeffrey McDonald. Satanic crime covered up by high officials at the highest level of government. Why? Well, certainly you want to get our 4 tapes out on satanic crimes. You'll want to get the, and you'll get it, of course, in CD as well. And then you want to get the book on satanic crimes. You want to go to William H. Kennedy's website, williamhkennedy.com, and look at his pages on the Bohemian Grove, where the leaders of our country go together on a regular yearly meetings and put on their black robes and hoods and hold their candles and have a simulated human sacrifice. And then, of course, you'll want to see the initiation ceremonies for Skull and Bones, to which both John Kerry and George W. Bush belong. And as they bow before Lucifer, they have this on video. It's all there at williamhkennedy.com. Understand, it's not imaginary, it's real. We have a great book called The Diary of a Devil Hunter, a man deeply involved in Satanism. And then, of course, he came out of it. He went around to police forces lecturing on Satanism. And then they'd send the man from the FBI to say, there is no Satanism, nothing to worry about. Just as J. Edgar Hoover for years said, there is no Cosa Nostra, there is no Mafia, all the time he was covering up for it. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, there's organized evil in our society. We have a 4-tape set on Satanism and deliverance. We have a 4-tape set on the supernatural, and a book that goes with that called The Beautiful Side of Evil, written by Johanna Michelson, who is a medium. That's the supernatural, and of course the book that goes with it, The Beautiful Side of Evil. Please go to our website, radioliberty.com. There's so much material there. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to watch my DVD called The Forbidden Secret, and that is a syllabus that comes with that. You really need to see the DVDs on They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. That's the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. You want to get the information, and then help us get the information out. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And if you think that we're going to defeat this by attacking Al-Qaeda, or attacking Saddam Hussein, or attacking Iran, or getting into a war with the Muslim world, don't you understand that they want to get us into the war with the Muslim world so they can kill literally hundreds of millions of people? That's what it's really all about. I mean, when you go and study the Second World War, and realize the Japanese kept trying to surrender it. If you doubt that, we'll send you the clipping out of the Chicago Tribune, free of charge. The Japanese kept trying to surrender. There was no reason to attack Okinawa. There was no reason to attack Iwo Jima. There was no reason to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, other than for the pleasure of mass murder and horror and terror. There really are people who have a different version of the world. If you'd like that clipping out of the Chicago Tribune, August 15th, 1945, telling how the Japanese have been trying to surrender, and I know it's true because I talked to General Albert Wedemeyer, who told me the same story. He was in charge of the military there in China. Well, we're out of time. My number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.